This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. You know, there were actually some pretty solid moments in John Kelly's Fox News interview last night. The White House chief of staff talked about averting nuclear war with North Korea. Laura Ingraham even had some pushback to Kelly about President Trump's celebration of China's President Xi Jinping. And in talking about the enormous criticism he received after he criticized a Gold Star widow, Kelly even admitted to wondering if being in Washington was, quote, all worth it. But all of that fell by the wayside when, in response to a question about the removal of Civil War monuments, John Kelly said this.
The lack of an ability to compromise led to the Civil War. And men and women of good faith on both sides made their stand where their conscience had them make their stand.
With all due respect, Mr. Kelly, I disagree. Slavery led to the Civil War, which is also why some historians reacted to Kelly's comments with these words: strange, depressing, profound ignorance, the Jim Crow version of the causes of the Civil War. And it's all stranger still because just a few breaths earlier, Kelly had accused Americans who want Civil War monuments removed as having, quote, a lack of appreciation of history. So let's take some time here to set the historical record straight. And helping us to do that is Michael Vorenberg, history professor at Brown University. He's also author of Final Freedom, The Civil War, The Abolition of Slavery, and the 13th Amendment. Professor Vorenberg, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Meghna. It's nice to be on the line with you.
It's good to have you. Also with us is Karen Cox, professor of history at the University of North Carolina, Charlotte. She's author of Dixie's Daughters, The United Daughters of the Confederacy, and the Preservation of Confederate Culture. Professor Cox, welcome to you.
Thank you so much, Meghna.
Well, before we dive into the specifics of all the compromises that were attempted prior to 1860, I just wanted to get the first reactions from both of you as to, you know, what your initial thoughts were when you heard that John Kelly had said a failure to compromise is what led to the Civil War. I mean, Michael Vorenberg, what'd you think?
Well, this is an old theory, and it is one that we associate with a previous era. A long time ago, there was a theory that a generation failed to come to a compromise, and that's why there was Civil War, as if there could be a compromise around an issue like slavery. So this is often called the blundering generation theory, and that is that a different group could have made a compromise. But behind that assumption is, like I said, this assumption that slavery was something that could be compromised with.
Yeah.
But my first reaction was there were compromises. Over and over again, there were compromises. And the people who couldn't compromise were the pro-slavery people. They had gotten concession after concession. Lincoln's Stand was a compromise. That is, slavery will exist, continue to exist where it will. But that was not enough. And they, fire eaters, mm-hmm. as they were known, pushed for a system whereby slavery could exist just about everywhere. And that was way beyond anything like a compromise. So
right.
In some ways, General Kelly's right. There was a failure to compromise, but it was only on one side, and okay. That is the pro-slavery side.
Okay, so we'll get more into that in just a minute. But Karen Cox, I wanted to get your take here. I mean, were you surprised, or perhaps not, I don't know, to hear John Kelly say failure to compromise?
I think my reaction was, oh, God, here we go again. We're going to get set back. Americans are getting set back in terms of their understanding of the history of the Civil War. And so, I'm sure most historians were shaking their head after hearing that. And my concern was that here's a person who's in the White House and has the respect of a lot of people, and he's basically espousing a false narrative of the war, and that's problematic.
Or at least a narrative that has long been put to rest by historical scholarship. I mean, because my understanding was in the years, Reconstruction years, for example, and perhaps even into the early 20th century, the whole reconciliation narrative between North and South was fairly dominant. I mean, Michael Vorenberg, is that a fair assessment?
Yes, it was a reconciliation narrative. It was a heroic narrative, and standing in the center of that was Robert E. Lee, who received quite a bit of attention in these remarks by General Kelly. Karen can speak to this more than I, because she's written quite a bit about monuments and other memorials that come out of the reconciliation. But Lee's role in this is important, the symbol of Lee, as someone who nobly surrenders and sort of steps aside and becomes the honorable man, despite the fact that he was effectively the leader of the most famous army in a rebellion.
Well, let's just
a traitor.
Let's just hear. I didn't want to cut you off there because you were saying that Robert E. Lee was a traitor. But let's just hear what John Kelly said yesterday about his views of Robert E. Lee.
I would tell you that Robert E. Lee was an honorable man. He was a man that gave up his country to fight for his state, which in 150 years ago was more important than country. It was always loyalty to state first back in those days.
So, Karen Cox, what interested me about that moment is that it seems as if John Kelly is working very hard not to say that Robert E. Lee fought to preserve the institution of slavery. But in the whole state versus country thinking that Mr. Kelly put forth there, isn't another way to look at it is that Robert E. Lee was saying, no, his country is the country that would fight to preserve slavery, and that was not the Union.
Well, he definitely, he doesn't even mention slavery in the entire interview.
Yeah.
So the other, flip side of that is that he acted personally in rebellion against his own country. By taking up arms, and he fought in. I mean, you can't get around the fact that he led an army and fought in a war that was essentially going to maintain slavery, and that's what's problematic, with a lot of what he was saying about Lee.
Right. I want to get back in a moment to the attempts at compromise that the United States went through in the decades before the Civil War. But just, to put in no uncertain terms the centrality of the institution of slavery to, the Civil War, I was looking at some of the documents of the Declaration of Secession from various states, and I just want to read a couple sentences from a couple of the states. Mississippi said, "Our position is thoroughly identified with the institution of slavery, the greatest material interest of the world." Texas said that non-slaveholding states had held a, quote, unnatural feeling of hostility to these southern states and their beneficent and patriarchal system of African slavery. Georgia said the South, with great unanimity, declared her purpose to resist the principle of prohibition of slavery to the last extremity. South Carolina said it objected to the election of a man to the high office of President of the United States whose opinions and purposes are hostile to slavery. So I guess what I'm saying, Michael Vorenberg, is to me, I'm one of those many people who are stunned that there can be any other read of the Civil War. I mean, I don't know what more to say than that.
Well, there's the wishful thinking that somehow a compromise could have been achieved around slavery. And we'll probably get to this later, but such compromises had been achieved, most notably in 1850. It was a compromise of 1850 was unsatisfactory to many parties, but it did compromise around the slavery issue. It gave us, unfortunately, things like the Fugitive Slave Law. So I think there's also this idea of a kind of denial that somehow we can believe in compromise without actually having to face the realities of what that compromise necessarily would entail, which would be an untenable moral position.
Right.
And so I think that's constantly what's going on when we talk about states' rights, this sort of holding on to an abstraction without facing the reality behind it, which is pro-slavery.
Well, so in the founding of the nation, there is the 3/5 compromise written into the Constitution of the United States, right? I mean, dealing with the compromise that northern and southern colonies had to reach that said enslaved peoples would be counted for the purposes of the census as 3/5 of a human being. Then we move to what? 1820 in the Missouri Compromise, when Missouri wanted to enter the Union as a slaveholding state, Karen?
Yes. And so, this is one of a series of compromises.
Yeah.
I think the professor is probably better equipped to speak on that. But yes, there's been a series of compromises over and over, as he said, and then it's always been about still maintaining this institution of slavery. Yeah.
So, Michael Vorenberg, I mean, I was just kind of jumping around there from the writing of the Constitution to the Missouri Compromise. There's the Kansas-Nebraska Act, 1854. I mean, there are many, many attempts here.
Yes, and then also, so even at, you read a number of the secession declarations. So even after the seven states of the Deep South have seceded, using these explicitly pro-slavery sentences, even after that, there are attempts to compromise. And Congress is trying to frame a compromise. They will fail. Actually, that's not entirely true. There is, for example, Congress puts out a constitutional amendment, proposed constitutional amendment, that would restrict, essentially ban the ability to interfere with slavery where it exists. And that passes Congress, gets the two-thirds majority needed, and is submitted to the states for ratification in March of 1861. And Lincoln, in his inaugural, mentions it and actually approves it. Of course, it becomes irrelevant much later on. So there were constant compromises or efforts at compromise, although there was never really any chance that those would succeed after secession.
Mm. Yeah, and then I just want to reiterate a point that you were making about that the Civil War certainly was ultimately inevitable because of the fundamental moral corruption when you're asked to compromise on a morally indefensible thing like slavery.
Can I add to that?
Yeah.
One could argue that it is because of compromise that the war came later than it might otherwise have come, right? Mm-hmm. So that it's because of compromises that you've mentioned and the compromise of 1850 that this, in a sense, you could argue is postponing the inevitable, and that, in fact, the story of compromise is the controlling story, is why the nation survived so long without a war.
Right. Well, I want to play another cut from John Kelly's interview last night, because remember, this entire moment in his interview was sparked by a question about what he thought about the removal of Civil War memorials. And here's actually how he started that answer.
I think we make a mistake, though, and as a society and certainly as individuals, when we take what is today accepted as right and wrong and go back 100, 200, 300 years or more and say what Christopher Columbus did was wrong. 500 years later, it's inconceivable to me that you would take what we think now and apply it back then. I think it's just very, very dangerous. And it shows you how much of a lack of appreciation of history and what history is.
Karen Cox, what's your response to that?
Oh, boy. Well, I think the only person who lacks an appreciation for history is in that clip is John Kelly. And it's not, here's the thing. It's like he's saying, well, you can't take whatever, we think today and apply it back. No one is even trying to do that. I think that it was wrong then as it is now. And no history is being erased here if a monument is removed. What's happening and what would be taking place is you're removing an artifact of the Jim Crow period. Mm-hmm. We're not erasing Civil War history. We're not, and nothing is being erased. History will still be there. History will be in books. We're talking about an artifact or artifacts of the Jim Crow era.
Yeah.
So this is what we're discussing right now.
Right. And I mean, to me, what I thought is, wait a minute. I mean, part of the job of historical scholarship is to apply the hard-won lessons of history and turn them back on the events, that got us here. Why shouldn't we be using the moral framework that we have today as a means by which to examine our own history? And then, honestly, to examine how we behave and how we organize ourselves in our societies today. I mean, John Kelly seems to be saying we shouldn't be doing that at all and just accept at face value what those people who, live through those events, say that they mean. And that seems to be a very strange take on the purpose of historical scholarship or just learning about history. Michael Vorenberg, your response to that?
No, I completely agree, Meghna. And that is what he's trying to say. Essentially, that there is a true history, and it's the history that he's talking about, And anything that would compete with that, he wants to relegate to political correctness. And, you know, that's what it becomes, is this rhetorical device to make it about somehow taking sort of lefty liberal values and creating a false narrative history. But that's not, of course, what's going on at all. What we have here is, as you just said, decades or a century of scholarship that allows us to take apart what is a false narrative. He is claiming this false narrative is, in fact, the truth. Also, there's another part, the clip you just played, which is really needs to be thought about. He says this is what society is doing. The trigger for this is not what society did. This is what a church in Alexandria did.
Right.
A church on its own terms, in its own congregation, in a democratic fashion, made the decision to remove plaques that were put up in 1870. And so this is a Jim Crow story. They were put up as a Jim Crow move toward the end, toward the period where Reconstruction is being pushed against. Furthermore, they're not being removed. They're being removed of their current location, and they will be relocated. So this is a church, an Episcopal church, that's doing this. It is a religious community. And it's also, and Kelly in the same interview talks about how he goes to Arlington to pray. And there's incredible hypocrisy here, because the community that's doing this is a religious community that's chosen a course that he just doesn't like.
Yeah. So I want to play one more piece of tape, because you mentioned the word prayer, and it, I don't know what to make of it. But Laura Ingraham asked John Kelly, what does he pray for?
I pray for world peace. I pray for our society that seems to be so broken right now and against itself. I pray for my family. I pray for my son and all the fallen. I pray for a lot.
Karen Cox, my last word goes to you, because I thought, you know what, Mr. Kelly, a lot of us pray for the exact same things, but it seems to be a long road to achieving those prayers for as long as the White House chief of staff dances around the issue of slavery in the Civil War.
Yeah, I mean, I hadn't caught that before, earlier, we could pray for, a true narrative of history and not a false one, and not one that he particularly ascribes to. And for the people who are, there's like double injustice there. There's the injustice of slavery, then there's the injustice of history as he's, perceives it and is trying to defend.
Yeah.
And so that to me is what the sad part is. And that's why I think as historians, we must speak up and we must correct what's incorrect.
Yeah.
So that this doesn't continue.
Well,
we're on an uphill battle when someone in the White House is able to say that and communicate a message that that people believe in, and just kind of reinforces that.
Yeah. Well, Karen Cox is a professor of history at the University of North Carolina, Charlotte. Thank you so much for joining us today, Professor Cox.
Sure. Thank you.
And Michael Vorenberg, professor of history at Brown University. Professor Vorenberg, thank you as well.
Thank you, Meghna. Thank you for having me on.
Listeners, let us know what you think. Send us a comment at radioboston.org. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.